Welcome to Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone. This is a propaganda analysis of a document titled Program Developed for Psychological Operations Command to Change and Crystallize Public Opinion. I don't have the document, but it was actually brought up in a episode of the Behavioral Panel by Chase Hughes, who is the leading military and intelligence behavior expert with 20 years of creating the most advanced behavior skills courses and tactics available worldwide. I quickly want to go over why public opinion is something so valuable, starting with a book titled Our Man in Damascus, the story of Eli Cohen, who was a Mossad agent in the 1960s, part of the Levon Affair in the 1950s, who infiltrated the Syrian government. This is an exchange at the Syrian border with a high Syrian intelligence commander. If so, with all the armaments we have with this excellent position, why can't we drive them, the Israelis, into the sea? If it were up to us, I assure you that the Israelis would have been gone long ago. The trouble is the Israelis have world sympathy, and the big wheels are protecting this little bastard nation. What about the Israeli army? Eli asked carefully. The man made a face. Yes, they have an army that any Arab country would be proud of, but as you will understand, that isn't what's stopping us. Then what is? Look, Kamel. Kamel is Eli Cohen's undercover name. We have better armaments than they have. We have several times more men. We have topographic superiority. But all this isn't enough in modern warfare. What we're lacking is the support of public opinion and the power fighting the entire West, which is behind Israel. Then why do the authorities proclaim war against the Jews morning and night? It's probably good for politics, but just between us, I may tell you it's very bad for the army. The second book I want to quote is Propaganda by Edward Bernays, often referred to as the father of public relations. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in a democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed. Our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, our ideas suggested largely by men we have never heard of. This is a logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society. Our invisible governors are, in many cases, unaware of the identity of their fellow members in their cabinet. He goes on, they govern us by their qualities of natural leadership, their ability to supply needed ideas, and by their key positions in the social structure. Whatever attitude one chooses to take towards this condition, it remains a fact that in almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social contact or ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons, a trifling fraction of our 120 million, who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world. Finally, a book written in the 1550s to show you how far the idea goes back by Etienne de la Boetie called The Politics of Obedience. He says, for the present, I should understand how it happens that so many men, so many villages, so many cities, so many nations sometimes suffer under a single tyrant who has no other power than the power they give him, who is able to harm them only to the extent which they have the willingness to bear with him, who could do them absolutely no injury unless they preferred to put up with him rather than contradict him. Surely a striking situation. If two, if three, if four do not defend themselves from the one, we might call that circumstance surprising, but nevertheless conceivable. In such a case, one might be justified in suspecting a lack of courage. But if 100, if 1,000 endure the caprice of a single man, should we not rather say that they lack not the courage, but the desire to rise against him, and that such an attitude indicates indifference rather than cowardice? In other words, the reason people recognize and follow the laws of Congress instead of the laws of the Pope or the Mormon Church or the Church of Scientology is simply the result of public opinion. That's why I thought this was worth making a video of, especially when Chase Hughes brought to light this inner document he had. So there are 6 points to this document. Number one, he says, create a small window of doubt or uncertainty. A very good example of this is Joy Behar on The View looking at her notes and saying, it's unlikely she did this research. So someone gave her the notes to say, Richard Spencer, the white nationalist, said he would vote for you, Tulsi Gabbard, because, you know, she opposes arming ISIS, al-Qaeda, and al-Nusra in Syria and Libya. She brought a bill to the congressional floor that would outlaw funding terrorists, and of course it didn't pass. So it's about creating a small window of doubt or uncertainty. There's no principled argument. I mean, how many different people like the same thing for different reasons? One person may support the existence of Planned Parenthood because they are pro-choice. Another might do so because they support the ideas of Margaret Sanger. Two people liking the same thing for different reasons is one of the most common things you'll see. So to say that Richard Spencer would consider voting for you in a world of 7 billion people, the idea that one lunatic would vote for her is not an argument. They're trying to create a window of doubt, associate far-right extremist Richard Spencer with Tulsi. Well, she must be bad. It's not an argument. It's simply triggering a small amount of doubt or uncertainty or extremism and associating it with Tulsi Gabbard. Number two, develop doubt through targeted questions. One of the best examples is Chris Hayes' show, Could Trump Be a Russian Intelligence Asset? The headline under Chris Hayes reads as, Chait, unlikely but possible that Trump has been an intelligence asset since 1987. This is a clear example of develop doubt through targeted questions. This here in the bottom left is an email from WikiLeaks from the Hillary campaign. It says, best approach is to slaughter Donald for his bromance with Putin, but not go too far betting on Putin re Syria. Brent. So they're creating the idea of doubt of the legitimacy of Trump's presidency. Could he be a Russian asset? Could he be going back to 1987? Perfect example of this. Point number three in the document cited by Chase Hughes, he says, introduce questions that enhance confirmation bias. Is Donald Trump racist? Here's what the record shows. What's the matter with libertarianism? In both cases, it assumes or puts forward the idea, plants the idea in the minds of the populace that Trump is racist. What we need to focus on is racism, as opposed to the aggression that the state is inherently involved in, by definition, of being a government. What's the matter with libertarianism? Assume something is the matter with the ideology of the non-aggression principle and holding government to the same standards you'd hold any other organization to. We actually have real-world examples of this exposed in the Church Committee. Operation titled Operation Mockingbird was a fully implemented CIA program to spread disinformation throughout the American media. CIA Director William Colby testified to the Church Committee that over 400 CIA agents were active in the U.S. media to control what was reported through American mainstream television, newspapers, and magazines. So this is not just some document that some guy who worked on psychological operations had. This is actually something he says and something we see constantly in the real world. Point number four in the document, he says, display information that confirms the bias on occasion. So in the third presidential debate, Hillary had mentioned that 17 intelligence agencies independently researched the source of the WikiLeaks hacking of the DNC servers and emails, and it was definitely Russia. This is according to 17 intelligence agencies. Not one, not two, not three, but 17. Are you telling me all 17 are lying, for God's sakes? Sam Harris said this to Scott Adams like four or five times in their discussion. For God's sake, 17. This was while they were running in the year 2016. And then June 29th, 2017, a correction was posted by the New York Times. A White House memo article on Monday about President Trump's deflections and denials about Russia referred incorrectly to the source of an intelligence assessment that said Russia orchestrated hacking attacks during last year's presidential election. The assessment was made by four intelligence agencies: Office of Director of National Intelligence, the CIA, and the FBI, and the NSA. Just three stellar organizations with, you know, great reputations we could really trust. The assessment was not approved by all 17 organizations in the American intelligence community. But they lie, they lie, they lie, they spread the lie. And then years later, once it's verified that they lied, they say, forget about it. Hillary supported the Iraq War, something that should have been that ruled her out from, running as a Democrat. They don't care. Joe Biden, their current dementia nominee, just supported the Iraq War as well. They don't care. They pretended to care, just like they pretended to know that 17 intelligence agencies were involved in finding out that Russia was behind the hacking of the DNC. It's complete nonsense. But what they did was they constantly displayed information that confirms the bias they already planted in the minds of the populace. Point number five, he says, reward the subject for having come to the conclusion or figuring it out. Two other times this was blatantly used that we have documents to refer to that was the CIA's use of journalists and clergy in intelligence operations. This was also part of the Church Committee. We also have a document, the motion picture as a weapon of psychological warfare, objective to exploit the potentialities of a motion picture as a weapon of psychological warfare for the United States. Survey of the situation potentialities. The motion picture is one of the most powerful propaganda weapons at the disposal of the United States. It can serve many diversified functions. Another place you could look is the CIA Entertainment Liaison, where they openly associate themselves with movies and shows. So it's through these mechanisms that they simply reward individuals for having come to the conclusion or figuring it out. So the more Russia stories they have, the more the person will go, oh, wow, I really did know that this Russia thing was real. I really did know that Trump was a racist. We have, finally, number six, expose the subject to a negative event in order to solidify the bias at the end. So Ron Paul is certainly been displayed by other Republicans as someone who doesn't care about America, someone who just apologizes for America while he allows atrocities of other countries to go unchecked. So if you look here at the closed captions, we have John McCain debating Ron Paul, and he says, "This isolationism, sir, is what caused World War II. In other words, all you have to do is associate this person with a negative event in order to solidify the bias. We're already biased against Ron Paul, you know, saying that invading other countries and killing civilians somehow turns people against America. That's not true. Oh, and World War II, that was a really bad thing. And of course, the reality is the opposite. U.S. intervention into World War I gave made it so that Great Britain had much more power than they otherwise would by staging the sinking of the Lusitania. This was verified by Yale University in a document published in 1928, in the 1920s, called The Intimate Papers of Colonel House, where the Lusitania was intentionally sent to get destroyed to justify entrance into the First World War. By the U.S. intervening, they were able to defeat Germany and give them the very unfavorable Treaty of Versailles, which made Germany much worse off than it otherwise was, leading to the rise of Hitler and the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which started World War II, along with him allying with Stalin and them both invading Poland. So it was not isolationism that started World War II. World War II was the result of big governments initiating violence against peaceful people. Also, he's not an isolationist in any way. He believes in voluntarily trading with as many countries and developing good relationships as possible. It's like saying, you don't believe in invading and murdering your neighbors, so you just want to be alone and do nothing? No, of course not. We also have a tweet by David Lammy. He says, 75 years ago, Clemente Attell's labor government built a fair society out of the rubble of World War II, associating or exposing the subject to a negative event. As we fight coronavirus, labor has the same message. After this crisis, we can't go back to the way things were before. We have to rebuild better. World War II, COVID, really bad. We have to rebuild better. Labor is the mechanism to achieve that end. Those are the 6 points mentioned in the document by Chase Hughes. I want to finish with this quote. In order to rally people, governments need enemies. They want us to be afraid, to hate, so we will rally behind them. And if they do not have a real enemy, they will invent one in order to mobilize us. Thank you for watching. Keith Knight, don't tread on anyone.